Part 6 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology, a teaching on non-delusion with Jack Kornfield.
Tonight I'd like to speak in particular about the quality of wisdom, or it's sometimes translated from a negative word in Sanskrit or Pali, which is non-delusion. In the process of exploring the Buddhist psychology, we've talked about awakening as a transformation or opening of energies, so that the energy of grasping and of desire, when transformed, becomes one of beauty and 100,000 skillful means of taking the energy of the love of form and turning it into a creative expression of the truth rather than a grasping. And how the energy of anger, Vajra energy, can turn into truthfulness and clarity. Or how the energy of contraction and fear can be transformed into loving kindness and forgiveness. The state of delusion, the state of consciousness of delusion, arises when we are out of touch with our true nature. It manifests as confusion, as being spaced out, as a kind of loss of understanding or ignorance. And when it is transformed, when this spaced out quality and confused quality becomes understood and transformed, it leads to spaciousness. From spaced out to spacious, from confused to open and clear, allowing for all things. The word for delusion, some of the words are avidya, which means not knowing, or moha, ignorance, a kind of primary ignorance, blindness. And it is seen as the root cause of all the kinds of suffering that we entangle ourselves in life. The samsaric repetition, samsara means the repetition of patterns of contraction and fear and suffering that we repeat in life. Does anyone know what that means for themselves, that repetition? That is not seeing or living from what is true. Two jewel merchants arrived at a caravansary in the desert. About the same time one night, each was quite conscious of the other's presence. And while unloading their camels, one of them could not resist the temptation to let a large pearl fall to the ground as if by accident. It rolled in the direction of the other, who with affected graciousness picked it up and returned it to its owner, saying, "Oh, that is a fine pearl you have there, sir, large and lustrous as they come." "How gracious of you," said the first owner. "As a matter of fact, it's one of the smaller gems in my collection." Now another Bedouin, who was sitting by the fire nearby and observed this drama, rose and invited these two to come and eat with him. And after they had their meal, he began a story. He said, "I too, my friends, once was a merchant with many jewels like you. But one day I was overtaken by a great storm in the desert. It buffeted me and my caravan this way and that till I was separated from my entourage and lost my way completely. And days passed. I was panic-stricken to realize that I was really wandering about in circles with only one camel left and no sense of the way back or which direction to walk in. Almost dead with starvation, I unloaded every bag on my camel's back, anxiously searching through them for the 100th time. Imagine my excitement when I came upon a pouch that had escaped my notice before. With trembling fingers, I ripped it open, hoping to find something to eat. Imagine my disillusionment when I found that all it contained was pearls." So delusion is being caught up in things as if they were important or real when they're not. And the repetition of those patterns. Delusion, denial is another word, a false sense of separation where we identify with a small self, grasping, deficiency, as if we exist in some separate way, as if the world were outside of us, different, and it did things to us, and we had to do things back to it. It's the place, really, of contraction and struggle. From the Christian Desert Fathers, another story for you. There were two old men who had lived together for many years, and they never quarreled. Imagine that. Now, one of them said, "Let us try to quarrel once, just like other people do." And the other replied, "I don't know how a quarrel happens." The first said, "Look, I put a brick between us, and I say, 'This is mine.' And then you say, 'No, it is mine.' And after that, a quarrel begins." So they placed the brick between them, and one of them said, "This is mine." And the other said, "No, it's mine." And then he replied, "Indeed, it's all yours, so take it with you." And they went away unable to fight with one another. So delusion is being caught up in those realities, the pearls, the bricks, whatever it happens to be. It is a cosmic forgetting of who we really are. The mystic poet Kabir. We sense that there's some sort of spirit that loves birds and animals and the ants. Perhaps the same one who gave a radiance to you in your mother's womb. Is it logical you would be walking around entirely orphaned now? The truth is you turned away yourself and went into the dark alone. Now you're tangled up and have forgotten what you once knew. Kabir says, "Who are you really, wanderer? Why not remember today?" So through the practice of attention, mindfulness, which means a profound attention to the senses, sights and sounds and tastes and smells, to this very body and mind with clarity, delusion, what we're caught or entangled in, begins to open up. And what comes instead in our experience is a sense of wakefulness, of returning to what my teacher Ajahn Chah used to refer to as the one who knows, that innate wisdom within us that is spacious and all-embracing of life and fearless. It's the wisdom of the Buddha when he says, "I see the myriad worlds of the universe as but small seeds in the great Indian Ocean, as but a drop of oil at my foot. I look upon the judgments of right and wrong as the serpentine dance of a dragon, and the rise and fall of beliefs as but traces left by the four seasons." It's that place in us that sees the play of life with understanding and wisdom. Now, in a practical way, how does this come about? It comes first as we cultivate in meditation or in a general way in our lives the capacity for presence or sacred attention. The Buddha spoke often about the magic of deep or true attention. I know of no thing more helpful, more directly liberating than your true attention, to really pay attention. So as we sit, which is a practice of this attention, we notice thoughts and fears and love and hate and jealousy and creativity. And what the attention that we cultivate asks is not that we be still, although that stillness comes at times, not that we be concentrated. It means rather that we open this capacity to be with what is, with what is so. Whatever it is, however things are. To not move away from suffering or change or loss or love or hate, to rest in the center of them. It's like the woman Kisa Gotami, remember, who went to the Buddha with her child who had died and pleaded for him as a master to bring the child back to life, and he said he would do it. And he sent her into the village to get mustard seeds from a house. Mustard seeds, the most common spice in India. But she had to get it from a house where no one had died. And she went from home to home to home. Do you have mustard seeds? Save my baby. Of course, we'll give you. Has anyone died here? Oh yes, my uncle who lived with us. One of my children. You know, the grandfather in the family just died. And not a single household could she find. And finally she came back to the Buddha and said, now I see. It happens to us all. So freedom, or non-delusion, wisdom, comes first from a fearlessness of our hearts, of our attention to whatever is created in this world, particularly to what our mind creates, to what minds do. If you want to be free, you have to look at what minds do. This is Buddhist psychology 101. Right? We look at love and forgiveness and what it creates. We look at greed and contraction and hatred and see their consequences. See them in the past. This is from a book on the de-discovery, rediscovery of North America, Barry Lopez, wonderful writer. He describes the arrival of Christopher Columbus and the first Spanish settlements in the islands of the Caribbean, and quotes the written account of a priest, Bartolomé de las Casas, from 1502, who was an eyewitness to what he called the obdurate and dreadful temper of those Spanish who arrived and attended their arrival with unlimited and closed-fisted avarice. He said, for example, in their search for wealth, one day in front of him, Las Casas, the Spanish troops that came with him on the ships dismembered, beheaded, or raped 3,000 people. Such inhumanity and barbarism were committed in my sight as no age can parallel. The Spanish cut off the legs of children who ran from them. They poured people full of boiling soap. They made bets as to who, with one sweep of a sword, could cut a person in half. They loosed dogs that devoured an Indian like a hog at first sight. They used nursing infants as food for their animals. Continuous recreational slaughter practiced by those who felt the slights to their personage, imagined insults, or thwarted in their search for gold or sexual congress were intolerable. It goes on, and I won't read any further to you. This is coming to the new world. All right, that's in the past, you say. But until that is seen for what it is, what do we have in the present? America as the largest arms supplier to the entire world. We sell $3 out of $4 of weapons to the underdeveloped world that are sold worldwide. Billions of dollars. 40 countries in Africa buy weapons from us. It's almost all of Africa. What does that do? We pay for our life by selling weapons, by arming the world. That's the greed, because we want the money. That's the legacy that started 500 years ago and not been faced. How about hatred? This is from a Buddhist teacher, Reverend Nakasone. The current hysteria against foreigners and immigrants violates the most cherished beliefs and highest aspirations of the Buddhist teachings. Non-citizens and illegal immigrants, these outcasts, have been set apart from the rest of the United States citizenry. For the Buddhists, the real outcasts are those who deny that we live in an interdependent world and who do not believe that all beings are worthy of respect. So we project our hatred on others as we got involved in the greed. We get so lost in the stories and the dramas that we forget what is the author of these stories, the source of them. In Buddhist psychology, again, mindfulness looks not just at the results, but at the causes. This is greed, contraction, grasping. This is fear. And these are the other possibilities: openness, wisdom, loving kindness, compassion. Rabindranath Tagore writes, "We imagine that our mind is a mirror, that it is more or less accurately reflecting what is outside of us. On the contrary, our mind itself is the principal element of creation. The states within us, what we believe, create the world that we all jointly live in together." So to understand this mind and heart and what its possibilities are, we learn to sit and see with a respectful attention, without judgment, without trying to change it, without even saying this is good or bad at first, just to hold it all in a compassionate and direct attention. That's the beginning of non-delusion, of wisdom, of seeing. A poem for you by Sharon Olds, a wonderful poet, about seeing things. It's called "I Go Back to May 1937. I see them standing there at the formal gates of their college. I see my father in 1937 strolling out under the ochre sandstone arch. My mother, with a few light books at her hip, standing with the wrought iron gate still open behind her. They are about to graduate. They are about to get married. They are kids. All they know is they are innocent. They would never hurt anybody. I want to go up to them and say, stop. Don't do it. She's the wrong woman. He's the wrong man. You are going to do things you cannot imagine you would ever do. You're going to do bad things to children. You're going to suffer in ways you never heard of. You're going to want to die. I want to go up to them there in the late May sunlight and say it. Their hungry, pretty, blank faces turn to me, their pitiful, beautiful, untouched bodies. But I don't do it because I want to live. I take them up like male and female paper dolls and bang them together at the hips like chips of flint as if to strike sparks from them. I say, do what you are going to do, and I will tell the story. So what does it mean to see things as they are? I've come over some years in my practice to enjoy looking in people's eyes and to see the eyes, no matter who it is that I look at, as the eyes of the Buddha. In so many different forms, happy Buddha and sad Buddha, frightened and angry Buddha, but underneath it, that same Buddha. To really look and see. To see what is true wherever it is to rest like the Buddha, without rejecting the truth of the world or turning away. To open with compassion and a willingness to the beauty of birth and nature and 1,000,000 forms, and to the incredible pain, the unspeakable beauty, and the horrible losses of hungry children this day on earth, of the epidemic of AIDS that spreads from country to country now, you know, in Asia, in India, and Thailand, and Cambodia, as it was in Africa and San Francisco. To deforestation that continues, to death itself. If we can look and see what is true and accept it, accept that we will die, that our marriage, our money, our children, our successes, our failures, all those things, in the moment, you know what? Gone. Your body, all those things, like a dream when you die. All the things that seem so important, your schedule book, right? Full of stuff. How then might we live? When we quiet ourselves, as we do, and face the dance of life that is there every moment, beating in our own heartbeats and breath, and attend to it, to a pain and attachment and love and hope and fear and wisdom and all those things, often what we first find is the things that we've avoided, the dark, our personal shadows, and the global shadow, the things that we haven't wanted to face. And if we can sit in the midst of them, if we can pay attention and feel hunger and greed and contraction and hatred and jealousy, and honor them, a light begins to shine through them, around them, bigger than them. A space clears so that we can see that even suffering is inextricably a part of life, that birth and death and joy and sorrow can't be separated apart. And there comes a kind of awakening as if from a dream. And the heart becomes great and disentangled from the fears, and the mind becomes open and amazed. If we pay attention to the quality of delusion, of confusion, of samsara, and the fears and grasping it creates, we see that this delusion is made of the boundaries and the fears within our own consciousness. It's like my daughter Caroline, when she wakes up with a nightmare in the middle of the night, only half awake, and talks about the monsters that are there. You know, the monsters? Where do they come from? We discover in the nature of delusion, if we look, that it is most deeply connected with our own identity. That this small sense of ourself, my goals, my money, my fears, my family, my history, my place, my needs, all those things that we grasp create delusion. We take it so personally. And then we fight the things that we think shouldn't be that way. We fight change and loss and aging and death. But there's always praise and blame and gain and loss, and hot and cold, and pleasure and pain. We fight it as if it shouldn't happen, not to us. True wakefulness or wisdom comes to us as an invitation to step out of the battle with life, to rest and see that it's okay just to be here for a moment, an hour, a day, in life, this moment as it is. And in a kind of stillness that grows through our attention, like the stillness that comes when you look at the stars at night, we begin to see what's true and make our peace with it, even with death. Ajahn Mahabua, the same forest tradition as Ajahn Chah, wrote that practice of the Dharma is the seeing of what's true with the full heart, using our inner discernment, our inner knowing. To watch over your own heart with mindfulness and discernment is to truly awaken the Buddha, to see the Buddha and the Dharma. The king of death comes to you. He warns and assaults the bodies of all world's living beings in line with the principles of his truth. You have to greet his warnings with mindfulness, discernment, knowing, and take out your own treasures, the path and the realization of freedom in yourself, and flaunt them in his face, braving death in the course of your effort. You and he, who have regarded each other as enemies for such a long time, will then become true friends and advisors. Neither of you to take advantage of the other ever again. To see what's true. To see that and rest in your heart of hearts, that which knows, which is timeless. Being nothing, we are everything, says Kala Rinpoche. Possessing nothing, we are part of this dance. A wise heart, the heart of wisdom, is transparent, open, connected to that which is sacred. What we seek is here in the present. Now one has to be careful, I have to be careful, because even in Buddhism, or certainly in religion and spiritual practice, they can interfere in some way with this clarity, this wisdom, this presence. Remember, Joseph Campbell described religion for most people as an inoculation against the divine, you know. That you go to church or temple or whatever it is and hear these things, and it's sort of to protect you so you don't have to face the mystery. And it's easy for meditation to become that as well. You know, that it becomes something you do to not really look at life. I notice in myself, I just got word that German translators are finishing doing A Path with Heart in German, and they wrote a letter saying that they hope I won't mind that they've shortened the book a bit. Their publishers there didn't want to publish quite as fat a book, and they dropped out parts of some chapters, including the chapter on the states of samadhi and the death-rebirth experience, a lot of that stuff. And I got upset at first. I thought, that's the deepest teachings in the book, you know. And the people in Europe, the other teachers and people who read it, they won't know how much I understand, right? How much I know. How enlightened I am, right? And they'll see me as somebody who kind of teaches popular Buddhism to the masses, right? But the states and the visions and the death and rebirth, all that stuff is true, you know, and people need to know about it. But then I looked at that and it was funny to see. I realized that's just another kind of grasping, kind of spiritual materialism that we can have, any of us can have about our spiritual life or our practice. The point is not to have any particular state or not to use the practice to reassure yourself so that you don't face what's true. It's not a protection from the mystery, but an opening. And as we open, then, what is profound turns out also to be very, very simple. The Buddha, after his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, was undecided about teaching. Who, he wondered, would be able to understand the Dharma to the depth he had penetrated? Who, in fact, would listen? His concern was not that the Dharma was too complex to understand, but rather that the truth of the Dharma, the law, the Tao, the way, was so simple that no one would believe it. What is it that he saw that's so simple? That this wisdom, this non-delusion awakening points to. Part of what it points to is that we don't exist as we think of ourselves. That's all done with mirrors, which is to say with our thoughts, the whole sense of separateness. And that there is a great space of consciousness to open to, and that all the boundaries that seem to separate us and others and the forms of life are all illusion. It's absolutely true. Not a philosophy, but a direct experience. And many of the forms of spiritual practice, concentration and stillness and surrender and prayer and meditation, the openings of the body, the mind, are simply ways to awaken us from the dream of separateness, from feeling like this is who I am and not that. to awaken us from the dream of needs and possession to the mystery of the stream of life, which is the truth, to awaken us to the eternal present. Now, for many, it used to be the natural world that would do that. Unfortunately, we don't have as much time in the natural world as we used to. You know, it's more spent in our cars or with our laptop or, you know, at our offices and so forth. Rilke, the great German poet, came to a point in his work, in his writing, in which he got stopped, in which the creative flow wouldn't move in him. He became depressed, stuck, uncertain, didn't know what to do. And it lasted for quite a time. So finally he went to Paris to visit another great artist of his era and a good friend, the sculptor Rodin. And he asked Rodin, "What should I do?" And Rodin said, "If I tell you to do something, you have to promise me that you'll do it." Interesting, huh, when people say that to you. And Rilke said, and was desperate, "All right, I'll do it." He said, "I will give you an assignment, and I assure you that it will unblock the creative energies of your life. For the next year, I want you to go as many days of the week as you can to the zoo and sit in front of the animals and watch them." That was his assignment. And it made an enormous opening and change in his life. I mean, as kids, if you were lucky, so many of us spent a lot of time outside by the streams. And there are all these little frogs by the streams. The frogs like mushrooms. They just spring up and you hear them right away. I don't know where they go. In the dry season, they come back. Frogs. You know, and the kids who come here for family day then go looking for the frogs, kind of hopping. Yeah, the frogs are hopping, the big kids are hopping after the frogs. And they look at the ants, like the ant hills, watch the ants coming in and out like the thoughts do in your meditation, right? Out of this mind and the ground. And they pick up sticks and get the buckeyes from the trees and open them and look at that beautiful brown, round, like avocado pit seed in the middle. And the rocks around here, a lot of spirit rock, the grounds and the rock itself, have this wonderful green serpentine in them. You can pick up rocks and the kids think, these are jewels. They are. So to awaken is that simple in some ways. It's coming back to this amazing thing of life that we're a part of and not separate from. And meditation is a gift to use our breath, our body, to cultivate that true or precious attention, and to learn again how to listen with our heart, with wisdom. This is Annie Lamott from her new book on writing called Bird by Bird. She says, "I have a tape of a Tibetan nun singing a mantra of compassion over and over for an hour. 8 words, over and over. And every line feels different, feels cared about and experienced as she is singing. You never once have the sense that she's glancing down at her watch, thinking, Jesus Christ, it's only been 15 minutes. 45 minutes later, she's still singing each line distinctly, word by word, until the last word is sung. Mostly things are not that way, that simple and pure, with so much focus given to each syllable of life as life sings itself. But that kind of attention is the prize." With wisdom, it is in a moment as if we awaken from sleep into the reality of the present. And in that moment, there's freedom. Not the freedom of getting and having, but the freedom that comes that realizes that you can never possess anything. You rent it for for a while. You have to, even your bodies, you give back. Your kids, try to possess them. They will let you know, right? This sense of understanding. And then there's this mystery, the fact that there are 1 million different kinds of beetles on the earth. Somebody said God just loves beetles, that's all, you know? Or that 70 years ago, before astronomy had come to the point that it did, Hubble discovered the first galaxy, only 70 years ago. Right? And then since that time, we've seen billions and billions, and recently this great wall of 30 million galaxies, all larger than our own galaxy. And here we are on this little rock spinning around our star 2/3 of the way out, and, you know, a medium-sized star and a medium-sized galaxy, kind of average. The mystery of gravity, that all things attract to one another. The mystery of love, which may be the same thing for all we know. Could be, couldn't it, really? Seems to be the same force. And with all of this attention and this knowing, not trying to become or grasp or possess or separate, there comes, you know, a respect for life, just for this moment, the preciousness of life, so we can act to end hunger and racism and violence and ecological exploitation and alleviate the 10,000 sorrows of the world. But there also comes somehow a trust, a rest in it, no matter how bad it is some days or some years or some millennia, how good it is others. There's somehow a tremendous sense that the presence and the heart that we have is really the pearl that the world needs. That whatever situation you find yourself in, great or small, what matters, the pearl that you bring, is your heart. I saw a film the other night. My wife and I were sitting up watching this documentary that was made some years ago about Carl Jung. And in it, there's these old black and white movies of Dr. Jung with his pipe kind of by his tower in Bollingen in the, you know, the lake in Zurich, talking about his life. And in it, he told a story, and it was really a story of trust. He said he was working with a patient that had come to see him, a woman. And she fell in love with him. Ah, Dr. Jung, this charismatic doctor, you know. And she thought he was the perfect man for her, and she was going to marry him. And he said, I told her very clearly, several times in a row in different sessions, I am already married. I'm a married man. I have no intention of marrying again. I am married. This is just your own fantasy. Nada, nothing, did not sink in. She came in the next time, Dr. Jung, we are soulmates, right? It's perfect. We are going to get married. So finally, at one point, he looked at her and he said, okay, we'll do it. This is an amazing therapeutic moment, right? Said, okay, we'll do it. And let us prepare. And so they spent some months preparing, talking about the wedding. She got the cards made up, where it was going to happen. This whole thing, imagine this, right? All the way up till the day of the wedding. And the night before the wedding, she was sitting preparing herself for the wedding, and all of a sudden, the spell broke. And she came to see him the next morning. She said, I don't have to marry you, Dr. Jung. This was all a fantasy in my own mind. And he said, yes. Yes, we had been talking about that before. And I was just astonished by the trust that he had in the process that he participated in with that woman. I don't know what his wife would have said about it. But there comes somehow in this place of wisdom, of non-delusion, there comes this enormous sense of the process of life as some great thing that moves through us. It's not that we control it. but rather that we are it, that it moves through us. There's an invitation to this greater reality, to rest in the knowing, in the one who knows, in our Buddha nature, and to offer a wise heart to the world around us, to feel the world and us as one. From the philosopher Thomas Traherne, "You never enjoy the world aright till the sea itself flows in your veins, till you are clothed with the heavens and crowned with the stars, and perceive yourself to be the heir of the whole world, till your spirit fills the whole world and the stars are your jewels, till you are as familiar with the sacred as with your walk and table, till you are intimately acquainted with that shady nothing out of which the world was made, till you love others so as to desire their happiness as your own." O nobly born, again from the Tibetan text that's whispered in the ear of those being born and those dying, O nobly born, each of you, nobly born, the prince or princess, the king or queen, each of us with the dignity of a Buddha. O nobly born, remember your true nature. Remember who you were before you took birth in this body and to what you will return. Do not forget this truth. The visions and appearances of the world will take all forms depending on your karma, on your fear and greed. No need to become involved with them, no need to be frightened of them. Rest in your true nature, my friends. Remember the clear light, the pure clear light from which everything comes, to which everything returns. It is your own true nature. It is home. Remember these teachings. Remember the light of your own nature. It is deathless. If you can look at all of the visions and experiences of the world and recognize that they are composed of the same clear light as your own mind of the whole universe, you will be free. No matter where or how far you wander, the light is only a split second, a half a breath away. It is never too late to recognize the clear light, the truth.
This concludes part 6 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology. Our program continues with part 7.